Welcome, everybody. My name is Barbara Rossing. I'm a member of the teaching staff here, and we'll have a conversation tonight lasting about an hour to cover a whole range of topics to get us ready for the 4th of July. I wanted to use as kind of a springboard here the 5-year anniversary of the Rio Earth Summit, which took place the last couple weeks at the United Nations. I've got a couple quotes here from the conference that I want to use to kind of start us out. But thinking about the theme of the 4th of July and sort of global citizenship, patriotism, I made up this hopefully catchy title here on golf courses, garbage, and globalization, and figured we could talk together about environmental issues at a number of levels. The global environmental crisis, a more local look, and a Holden look as well. And speaking at those various dimensions will be Jonathan Frerichs from Lutheran World Relief, who is going to start at least with the golf courses. He and I were on a hike the other day, and we were talking about the scourge of golf courses, or the environmental problems that they represent globally. Tom Evans works for the Wisconsin Geological Survey, and he'll talk about mining locally and globally. And Chris Addis was the garbologist at Holden this past winter and is also a geology major, just graduated from Gustavus College. Actually, three of us are, I had to count myself as a geologist tonight. I was a geology major in college, although I haven't done much with it since then. So, are you a geologist?
No, but I always wanted to be.
Okay, so I figured what we could talk about tonight is the way that your stay at Holden is affecting your environmental thinking, the way you're thinking about it in your congregation, the way you're thinking about it as an American or as a citizen of another country. I brought with, to start us out, from the New York Times here, the June 27th, one of the front page stories was about the United Nations conference. Clinton defers curbs on gases heating globe. A lot of G's in that too. But it sounds like that the meeting was a great disappointment, especially on the greenhouse gas issues, that indeed no progress has been made globally since the Rio Earth Summit on the issue of carbon dioxide. And in fact, the United States is one of the great sort of foot-dragging nations on this issue. So I'm particularly interested in environmental issues. At the seminary where I teach, I work on this a lot with our students. And it's one of the issues that I personally grapple with in thinking about the question of patriotism and facing what Independence Day is about tomorrow, and wondering if we need to start thinking more in terms of interdependence. So we'll invite each of the panelists to open with a few remarks and then throw the ball to all of you to join in the conversation as we go all over the globe and all over the map on environmental issues.
My name is Jonathan Frerichs, and I'm going to take a crack at the three things in the top title in 3 minutes. Just by saying, first of all, if you don't remember any other thing, I think it's important to remember that the United States population is 5% of the world's population, and yet we consume 30 to 35% of the world's resources to live the way we do. That is probably the most important fact underneath any discussion we have on a forum topic like this. And interestingly enough, we used to consume 40% of the world's resources. It's gone down to 35. It hasn't actually gone down. It's actually gone up. But other countries are catching on and consuming more. And so our share of the bigger pie, finite though it still be, is less than it was. So it's a confusing statistic. We're actually doing worse than we were 20 years ago. But we look like we're doing better vis-a-vis the rest because more people are behaving like us. And if you want to look into the future and get depressed, ask yourself what will happen if the Chinese begin to buy automobiles. Or if the Chinese begin to eat meat in any quantities. Or if the Chinese begin to keep food cold or buy food that you have to keep cold. Because that will tip the balance right out of all kilter. Now, just to speak briefly about golf, how many golfers we got here first. Okay, I'm sure that I love you, and I'm sure that I respect the game that you like. I've never played it, so I'm really taking a wild shot here. But I know that in the third world, which is essentially what I'm trying to speak for, golf courses is the fastest growing form of land development. And it's not serving the common person. It's serving the people who have the money to travel to warm climates where golf grows well. And it's pleasant to be there and to play it. And they are the people who, the multinational corporations who are building these courses, are chewing up traditional burial grounds, agricultural lands, rainforests, swamps, you name it, in the fastest growing form of land development on the planet. For a game that is played by whom, especially when you have to travel internationally to play it. We hear about Japanese players who are willing to pay $250,000 to be members, and then to pay how much a day to do it. I'm in favor of green golf. I'm sure that the Scots who invented it did not have all of the accoutrements we're used to now. And I think that it could be played in an environmentally sensitive way. A regular golf course, if the people aren't conscious of the problems created by golf, is not only an incredible monoculture, wiping out all the variety of plants and animals in that area and replacing it with little tiny pieces of grass, but it uses something like 5 times the fertilizer and 7 times the pesticide of farming. And we know that farming is no handmaiden of the Lord in terms of its treatment of the environment. So there's a huge problem here. And there's actually an NGO, a non-governmental organization, to help people fight golf course development in places like Mexico and Thailand and Malaysia. It's something we need to think about in this framework of consumption, lifestyle, what it takes to have fun, and how much of the Earth's resources each of us are entitled to for our own pleasure. A quick comment about garbage. To me, the important thing about garbage is not what you do with garbage. It's where you get it from. Now again, if the world ate like Americans, the world could only support 1 billion people. But if the world ate like Italians, you could support 5 billion people. Eating a balanced diet like Italians do, and they know how to eat, right? Italians? How many people like Italian restaurants? We had it tonight, didn't we? Viva Italia. If the world ate like Indians, the figure is something like 15 billion people. And with that, what would be the garbage function of that kind of equation? How much garbage does an Indian household produce? And what kind of garbage? The good Lutheran insurance company, Aid Association for Lutherans, put out a little book about conservation. And they have two statistics in there that I have been unable to forget. One is that if you take all of the drink containers which Americans use in 2 weeks, the disposable drink containers, and you have you been to New York and seen the World Trade Center towers? Those two big 130-story buildings, almost as big as Chicago's? If you treat those as two giant garbage cans, the drink containers we throw away in 2 weeks would fill them both to the top, like garbage cans. Every 2 weeks, two World Trade Center towers. A vast difference from what an Indian household or an Italian household would do. Okay, unless they start living like us, which they're starting to do, thanks to globalization in media and advertising and consumer habits in trying to tell us what it is that we need to live. The other statistic was, and I'm sorry that my fellow panelists came in drinking from one, but the unrecycled aluminum, let's have a little conflict on the panel, okay? The unrecycled aluminum cans in the US of A, and this is from AAL.
Oh, we're recycling here.
No, 60% get recycled. Praise God for holding. But the 40% out there that don't get recycled, according to AAL, this conservative company from Appleton, Wisconsin, in 3 months, you could rebuild the entire commercial airline fleet of the United States from the aluminum that is in the 40% of drink cans that don't get recycled. How long can we live like that? How long can the world support a country that lives like that? Now, globalization, if I may, let's just defer to Doonesbury for a minute. Anybody follow Doonesbury when he went to the Nike factory in Vietnam? Well, the statistic there was that if Nike paid its workers in Vietnam the same amount, if it shared out among them the same amount it gives to Michael Jackson.
Jordan Jackson.
Who is he?
Jordan.
I don't watch basketball. But, if they paid...
He's for Chicago.
Okay. If they paid their workers what they give him, divided it up among all the people in their factories in Vietnam, they would have a living wage, each of them. But the fact is they don't pay them that. And I brought along with me, not knowing there would be such a panel, a news story about this very thing, about Nike. Jardine Fleming Securities predicts that the next non-Western economy set to take off, are we getting excited? Is Vietnam. The reason? Nike, the shoemaking giant, has opened a factory there. Nike has gone to several countries with low wages, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Indonesia, and China, and helped boost wages and economic development. Key factors for Nike include these when they go to a country: a stable, authoritarian political system, good infrastructure, and a friendly climate to business. After Nike leaves a host country in search of lower wages, the nation is usually ready to move on to high-end manufacturing and a more democratic system, according to Business Week. And what's this got to do with our topic? The process of getting rich selling and making Nikes, because when you buy a Nike for $70, it came out the factory door for $12. And the person who made it got 6 cents. So in between there's a lot of margin, and a few people in this globalized economy are doing very, very handsomely. That's what Nike has to do with globalization. We can talk about Microsoft, we can talk about Walt Disney, we can talk about McDonald's, we can talk about any number of things, Gap, in the same exact dynamic. And we're at the point where the 10 richest people in the world today have 1.5 times the income of the 48 poorest countries. The 10 richest people in the world, the people who are sitting on top of empires like Nike, have the same 1.5 times the income of the 48 poorest countries. Excuse me, that's more than 3 minutes.
All right, Jennifer. Thank you, Jennifer.
It's going to be interesting to see how you get a common thread out of all of this. That'll be the challenge.
But... Oh, it's the 4th of July.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to talk about was something that really came up in one of Jonathan's earlier lessons this week, in which he was showing a video of Peru and showing a U.S. Company operating in Peru in the mining, milling, and smelting of copper. And I work a lot with mineral resources in the state of Wisconsin, which involves a lot of regulation, and we talk a lot about companies coming into Wisconsin, which has very good mineral potential, and they want to mine there. And you know, what should we know about their environmental track record elsewhere? And if we know that, what should we do about it? I'll get back to that perhaps. But the point is that when we see the images of that copper company in Peru. And I believe, Jonathan, that the words you were using were something like 20 times the contaminant levels in the effluent that were going out into the waters and into the air. This is a Phelps Dodge operation, and the
is that a U.S. company?
Yes. And what they're doing is basically, obviously, not permissible in the United States. And I guess the question is, are we not, you know, exporting our pollution to other countries, to developing countries? And we have policies that might encourage that exportation of pollution. Some of our land policies, for example, I talked earlier this week about the 1872 mining law, and certainly a law that many people feel needs to be reformed. But one of the issues in reforming it is if you reform the law and make it more difficult for companies to work in the U.S., aren't you just forcing them to go overseas where they can find other resources and export their pollution, work under systems in which the environmental regulations are not anywhere near what they are in the United States? Don't our land policies kind of force them overseas? The same argument is made about our environmental controls. We generally have, compared to the rest of the world, strict environmental controls. I know in the state of Wisconsin, our environmental controls on mining are considered among the toughest in the U.S. But what is this kind of regulation doing? Is it not, in fact, forcing companies to export their pollution elsewhere? And is there any way that we, either as a state or as a nation, can require that companies going overseas behave in certain ways? And I'd like to propose, you know, a couple of points there. The argument being that if metal markets are truly global, does it not make some sense to try to think about establishing global environmental expectations for companies? One of the things we've seen recently since the Rio conference, we've seen, which is one manifestation, actually the conferences go back, what, to the Stockholm conference in 90 or 91 or whatever. I was reading today, preparing for this, that there have been something like 800 international accords reached since that time dealing with the environment. Basically, they're around things like limiting the total amount of chlorofluorocarbons that you're going to be releasing, or cutting them back by a certain percentage, and countries agree to do this. One thing I think we need to do is that when we look at international regulatory postures, that we ought to look at specific industry. We ought to make them industry specific and not contaminant specific. It would make it more parallel the way we do it here, and I think we would get better response if it's more specific. It's not quite so soft. We need to make track records in other countries relevant to whether or not a company can operate here in the United States. We need to think about adopting international environmental standards to try to strike and get international environmental accords, which will actually establish effluent standards, for example, for copper operations. There is a bill in Congress, for example, right now, to require tobacco companies to comply with the advertising restrictions that they are proposing to agree to in the new tobacco agreement here in the U.S. to a bill to make them comply with the same kinds of advertising restrictions internationally. I would argue the same kind of tack could be taken with environmental controls to require that companies operating in the United States or owned with substantial portions of U.S. Investments must behave in a way that is consistent with U.S. environmental controls, even when they're operating on the international market. I think what we really need to be thinking about doing when we talk about these multinational corporations and international markets is to try to think of ways to come up with some kind of an expectation of global behavior, as well as, or in addition to, our expectation of local behavior. And I think there are ways through tax policies and environmental policies that we can create a mechanism to enforce and also to encourage global behaviors.
Thank you. Chris, a view from Holden.
All right, a view from a garbologist. Well, one of the, probably the strongest impact doing garbology for 7.5 months here at Holden was basically the amount of garbage we have even here at Holden. I think Holden is probably one of the most ideal places to reduce garbage because we order our food in bulk. We're very conscientious of where we get it from. and the packing that is that the food is contained in. We usually order with the least packing. We don't get stuff that has styrofoam packing in it. If there was, we write to the company and say, you know, please don't send that up here. We don't want to deal with styrofoam peanuts. But even with all that in consideration, it's amazing how much garbage we have even here. But through our sorting process, how many have done garbology here? It's amazing, you know, you have a full truck and you sort it, you recycle what you can, you come up with maybe 4 landfill bags, about like this. And if you think, if every American did that, our landfill problem would be much less than it is now. We recycle probably 2.5 times more than we do with landfilling. So we'll send out 2.5 buses full to one bus of landfill. We compost. Composting is kind of a problem here at Holden. We do it, but it's so much because of health health requirements that if any food is out on the table, it has to be thrown away. So we create a lot of food waste in that sense. So it's always helpful at Holden when the waitress and the cooks say, you know, only take as much as you guys need at the table. It makes a huge impact for garbology because we only have 10 bins of compost up there. And they fill real quick because we need to add sawdust and ash to keep it light enough and less dense. Otherwise, it just sits there and rots. And it's not fun shoveling out raw food. I've been there, done that, and I don't want to do it again. So we add that in, and that creates more of a bulk. Hopefully, it will get done in 8 weeks. But we have that problem of we have so much food to compost that sometimes we run out of room. And then we have to throw it just on the side, even though we have an electrical fence, but that still attracts bears, and then we get into the whole ecology problem. It's amazing also how quickly people can be indoctrinated into the thinking of separating garbage. I went home back to Minnesota in January, and my brother was throwing away a cardboard, or a tag, some tag boards, just a cereal box. I'm like, don't throw that away. What you doing? And he's like, what's your problem? I'm like, that's tag board. You recycle that. And he's like, oh boy, here she goes again. You know. But it's so easy to get people to start thinking. You know, burnables. You know, like Kleenex or hand towels. You know, and all the recyclables you have. You have office paper, tag board, cardboard, newsprint, all the bottles and aluminum cans, tin can, miscellaneous metal, anything. All that stuff can be recycled. And one of my grudges, I guess, is that as consumers, we don't think of the mining industry having to deal with us, you know. We're driving around our cars, you know, we're using fuel, but yet we call them kind of like the black sheep. And we don't think of that as our responsibility at all. But in fact, if we are recycling everything we can and we're buying from companies that are using recyclable material, I'm not an economist, but I would think that, you know, that we'll cut back on the demand. So they'll be supplying less, but with the whole international thing, I'm not well schooled on, so I'm not sure about that. But it's just kind of a basic knowledge of by recycling, we have to mine less, and that will cut back on pollution. And also, just an awareness of how much that is mined, that needs to be mined. Usually, I can say in a room, you know, look at everything in this room, and whatever it wasn't grown has been mined. This is kind of a bad room to say it in, but But usually just walk around and just say, wow, you know, that aluminum was mined. Oh, yeah, you know, that was mined. Once you do that and actually are looking around, it's really amazing, everything that we do mine, from, you know, glass to gravel, to copper to silver, everything. And we can cut back on that mining demand by recycling. And we try to do it to the best that we can at Holden. Holden is a great place for educating, and that's what we try to do. If I had my way, I'd have every single person that comes to Holden, including guests, go through Garbo, because it's extremely educational, I believe. And even though it's not necessarily the most pleasant job, it will change the way you view the global problems that we're having. Even here at Holden, you know, we really don't have that much garbage, you know, as compared to the rest of the world. But yet, we have so much garbage. Even during the winter for 60 people, there's still a lot of garbage. And it's really eye-opening.
Thanks. Just to follow up before we open it up, you can join the garbage crew. It's not mandatory, but it's a really great way to get to know volunteers. And it, in a sense, it's not the most pleasant job, but it really is fun. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's fascinating and just takes a couple hours. So that's a volunteer opportunity that's always available. Okay, now is your chance as the community of Holden here to speak to this issue. We just, as a panel, bat around some initial ideas to get the conversation going. But I know that many of you have a lot of experiences in your life that would be invaluable to hear from also. Why don't I just say, with forums, you really are all the experts. And it's not like we're teaching faculty here and you're the listeners. We want everybody to get into the conversation. We don't have to agree at all, and we don't have to come to consensus at the end. I would guess that most of us are here tonight because we love the earth and are concerned about this issue as part of our Christian faith. Beyond that, we probably differ on a lot of these issues. So feel free to give voice to your own ideas, challenge what you've heard on the panel, or speak to one another. I'd love to hear what ideas are working in your congregation or your community and what you struggle with, be it golf courses, garbage, or parking lots, as I do, or whatever. How about when you speak, why don't you identify yourself, give your name and where you're from, and just jump in and we can start to hear from some of you. Comments? Uh-huh.
Well, I'm Dave Honeycutt from Bellevue, Washington, and I showed up here because I was going to read the title about golf courses and garbage globalization. I kind of picked on the former part of it because it's been an area of my interest for about 35 years. And you didn't really touch on it in great depth, but I would take issue with the idea that there's any environmental catastrophe being created by golf courses. And I would promote the argument quite the contrary is the case. I've played golf courses all over the country, all over the North America. And I've seen the new ones that have come online, and the design requirements for new golf courses today are among the most stringent environmental concerns that they have to deal with. And rather than causing problems with surface water runoff or wetland areas or other sensitive areas, I think that they actually enhance them. And I've seen that to be quite the case. And courses I've played in areas that formerly were wetlands, formerly were natural areas, are more efficient ecosystems now. Runoff is better. The fertilizers and insecticides, pesticides that you talk about are not put back into the water. People are required to put in drainage systems that have submerged holding tanks, and they have to siphon off the insecticides and pesticides before they let the water back into the self-enclosed systems. Golf courses don't use public water because they can't afford to irrigate with public water. So they use a self-enclosed system. I have a good case in point. 10 miles down the road is Desert Canyon. if you feel like that would be a good example of how a golf course has been carved out of the desert. Crosswater down in Bend was carved out of a wetland, and there's been no impingement upon the wetlands. In fact, they work more efficiently now, by all reckoning. I'm trying to think of, oh, the plateau up on East Sammamish is another one that was carved out of the Beaver Lake wetlands. And before they could even site the clubhouse or put in the first tee, they had to deal with every area of wetland, surface water runoff, and disposal of pesticides. And they did it to everybody's satisfaction. I mean, nobody is issuing a peep, you don't hear about it. Mm. I agree with the fact that golf courses address a very small economic segment, but that's never been, that's not new. That didn't happen in the last 10 years. And in fact, in the last 12 to 18 months, we've had a fundamental shift in the whole sport because of the emergence of Tiger Woods, promoted by Nike, I might add. But he is going to open the game to the inner city. So, I mean, you know, yeah, they build courses in Mexico, they carve them out of the desert, but if you went down there and asked the local people, I think they'd say, don't take it out because at least it's a paying job, you know, and they didn't have it before. I've gone to Mexico, I've seen some of the, you know, what we would call, I suppose, luxury resorts, and, I mean, if they weren't there, I mean, I don't know what these people would do for, you know, to earn a living, but what I really took issue with is that the idea that I would argue for the idea that golf courses are not causing economic or ecological malfeasance. And I've been in the real estate business for 20 years. I've been prior to my company, when I worked with Warehouser Real Estate, which develops a lot of golf courses now because they kind of get rid of their old timberlands that they can't reforest. And golf course appraisal is one of the areas that I'm focusing my business on because it's something I can put a vocation and an avocation together. And I just don't find it to be the case that golf courses are causing any ecological problems.
Okay. I should say, in Jonathan's defense or whatever, I always try to come up with catchy titles so we can get people to come to me. So I thought that golf courses would be an interesting sort of hook, and it sounds like there are differences. And part of it sounds like you're speaking more to the North American situation. You're speaking third world.
I'm talking the rest of the world.
No, I included a Mexico in that. I think
well, let's talk about that. I was in Mexico, and some peasant women came up to me when I had said something about golf courses in a meeting, mm-hmm. and they wanted to know who this group was that was helping indigenous people fight golf course development. Mm-hmm. And they were just tickled pink that somebody out there had the same problem that they had, because there was about to be one made. Mm-hmm. Right on top of their village lands.
That was just north of Mexico City. I know there was
south of Mexico City.
Yeah, there was a big debate about that. I understand.
And that's happened over and over again. And who is it going to serve? You say they get jobs. What are the jobs? Cleaning the rooms. You know.
But there was no rooms before to clean, and at least a job.
They were living. They know how to live. They've been there for tens of thousands of years. There's ways to work with them with their environment. They don't need us and our golf course to improve their way of life.
How about others on golf? If you want to start with that, or Mark? Say who you are.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm Mark Mathias. I live here at Holden. And I would take exception, or disagree with you, I guess, in that I feel like you're in essence, you're saying golf courses sort of are fine with the ecosystem, but you talk about places living put, where they're not part of the natural ecosystem, being carved out of the desert. For example, at that point, you take a lot of water in order to be green. You mentioned Weyerhaeuser, putting them in places that were once forests, but are no longer, and can't be forested for whatever reason. So we're taking a natural area and making it, in essence, that particular climate, that particular geography, an unnatural setting by By just trying to grow green grass where green grass wouldn't grow without a lot of human assistance.
Sounds like, I mean, this is maybe a benefit here. I know nothing about golf, but I know we've had many forums up here in Holden in the past on the logging issue, for example, where we've had significant disagreement on that, or on fishing and hunting. The consensus, I mean, everyone loves the land, but we view it quite differently. And I think it is really important for Holden to be a place where we can talk to each other. So thanks for those different views. Others?
It would seem to me that whether you want to talk golf courses, you're really basically talking about what kind of an acceptable standard of living do we want to live with. I don't think any of us would ever give up a car. And yet, that car is changed, you know, drastically, whether here or any place. I mean, in other words, whether you're talking about golf courses or mining, I mean, it's a standard of living that we have grown to become accustomed to. That I think what Jonathan was saying is that being exported over to another area that isn't used to that, which is elevating, which is causing. And I guess that's the issue is, where do we want to settle into us? What kind of standard of living do we want to, I think with your recycling, there's a lot of conveniences that you're saying about recycling, and yet Jonathan did mention the can of pop that you're holding. So we talk about certain things that I think none of us would probably want to go back to what our, ancestors had to go through to get to this place. You know, we like some of our conveniences, we like the golf courses, whatever. Where's our standard of living going to stop?
Can you say your name?
My name's Paul Gamblin.
And you're on the volunteer staff?
Right.
And where are you from?
Wausau, Wisconsin. Next to a Crandon mining company.
That's right.
I have the same problem trying to get in there because of the problems.
I'm Nancy Winter from Seattle, and just connect to know Mark's doing a bunch of stuff with movies, I think the kind of issues. And has anybody seen the movie Brassed Off? Have you seen that? It's a brand new English film, or it's the opening of American Now. It's about the closing of a mine in Yorkshire in 1992, right at the end of all the mines and Margaret Thatcher closed. And part of the tension I think we're addressing, Jonathan's giving us helpful information on what happened globally. And then we look at the post-industrial revolution stuff that happened. But that's also like timber in our part of the world here, where you have dying towns also, run over towns first by the timber industry and nothing to do and nowhere to go. And then, if you're watching this movie, I would recommend it around this issue because it's you're cheering for these miners and their union and their jobs and their lives and their towns, and at the same time, you know that for the earth, that mine has got to close. Now you can't have coal; you can't burn coal. It's a good way of addressing I keep thinking about it. Mm-hmm. Just the huge tension globally we have around the entire issue in all aspects of our life and culture.
And just a comment. I really don't have much of a problem with mining as an activity when it's properly regulated. And for example, the Crandon mine, which I'm going to talk about next week in part, properly handled and managed will have very minimal impact on the environment. You cannot obviously mine without having an impact on the environment. That's the very nature of it. But the effort is how do you manage that impact and minimize that impact. And also the socioeconomic impacts. How do you manage and minimize the potential adverse social economic impacts? I don't have much problem with mining. And when we get into the issues of how much of a resource is there, you know, globally, and are we going to be running out? I mean, it gets tough because the arguments are when you begin to look at reserves to production ratios, you know, those ratios actually are getting more favorable as we get better with our ability to process ore, and we discover other ore. Now, ultimately, it's a finite game, and ultimately, it has to end. But those are tough arguments to make. The only argument I really want to make is that what I hate to see is that we have a particular environmental ethic here, and we have a global economy which allows our companies, which, and I'm not saying you shouldn't allow them, I'm just saying there needs to be some thought given to how we might affect those decisions, where they can simply go elsewhere and do it at whatever level they choose to, and obviously to make a profit, which is not a bad thing. I'm just simply saying that's a struggle, I think, where we establish strict standards and then we have no expectation whatsoever that companies which we support with our money, and we buy stock in those companies, we have no expectation of their behavior anywhere else. We simply don't seem to care what they do in Peru or Papua New Guinea, where a big, you know, big mining is going on right now, and the Bukit Teti mine. We simply don't care about that. We're very cautious here, but we don't seem to care if it goes outside our borders. And I think there's an ethical issue involved in that particular problem.
Others on garbage or Carol Nolte.
Carol, I'm trying to think of a specific example. I mean, the only thing I can come up with is, like, say, tobacco. That the reason that we're not, our tobacco companies aren't crying even more than they are is because that they're selling plenty of tobacco abroad. So my suggestion is that we take the tobacco fields and turn them into golf courses. What else? I mean, it seems to me like maybe we have a country that has far more regulations than others about all kinds of things, but I don't know what those other things are. Can you give me some other examples besides tobacco?
Automobiles.
Okay.
Our cars are clean.
Cleaner, yeah.
Or they were, and now they've gotten less clean as the fleet standards have changed, and as we're all buying Rancheros or whatever, you know, the big things.
Yeah.
You know, we're just letting these things go in the wrong direction as if we don't know better. And I think we're farther behind than we were in terms of people's psychology with some of these things that definitely have to be lined up with the rest of the world eventually. And the kicker to it is we're in the midst of an enormous export. Our biggest export is our culture.
Yeah.
And that culture is exporting this lifestyle. And that old dynamic, which is as old as the first movie from Hollywood, but it's bigger now than ever, is that this is the way to live. You know, Baywatch is the most popular television show in the world, or was last year. Before that, it was something else. I remember when it was Dallas. And that's what's becoming the standard. That's what's becoming the lifestyle, the trendsetter, the picture in people's eyes. And it has with it environmental. Because you can't have a world with more than three Americas on it. You just can't. Unless you want to extract a lot faster. I mean, and what I'm amazed at is we hear this word, Clinton says, we got to grow the economy.
Yeah.
I think the word grow is an alibi for sin. I really do. Because what he's telling us is when the rest can just catch up and grow as fast as we can, then everything will be okay. I mean, to me, that's, what are we, kindergarten students?
Let me just pick up on what Chris brought up to shift the subject, I guess, a little much more locally to the question of lifestyle change and garbage. I see a number of Holden repeats here in the audience, so I know that you've been up here more than once. Have people made actual changes in your own garbage practices? And can you talk about that and how perhaps it's transformed any others in your congregation or how you're working on it?
I'm Frida Scheiber from Greenbelt, Maryland. I've been serving on the Recycling Advisory Committee for my little community, and it's been a real eye-opener, and it's amazing how recycling and trash are tied together. You can't separate the two. Yes, and politics. I have an issue that I'm really struggling with, and I'd like to know if other people are. I'm a very faithful recycler, and I've gone down to City Hall and said my 2 cents worth and about increasing recycling and everything. But the problem is the market is so volatile. Like, for instance, mixed paper, which is magazines and junk mail, office paper, whatever. The market was incredible. Like 2 years ago, we could get like $7 a ton. Now it's bottomed out, and now we've got to try to find some other place to pick up this paper. And that's one of the real big problems we've had with recycling, is that the market goes up and down and fluctuates. And how do we get an incentive going for people? Because all the time we have residents saying, why should I recycle? I have to pay for it. And then we get into state law, which requires recycling. County laws require recycling. And I don't know if there's anything like maybe nationally have an agenda, or I don't know how to have a market set or something, so we can encourage people to recycle more and also to reuse things, and also looking at being a real sensitive consumer. And I go to the store and I will not buy things that contain plastic, or I'll avoid it at all costs, because I know it's so difficult to recycle most plastics. And I'll buy something that's more expensive in glass, which I know, you know, can be recycled. But it's just trying to increase that awareness. But really, the market issues are what really, really bothers me. I don't know how other people are doing in their communities about it.
We're having a problem right now with the Chelan recycling, is that they won't take green glass, and now they're telling us they won't take brown glass. Mm-hmm. So we're not real sure what we're going to do with it. I guess we're going to send it to the landfill, and we'll still crush it so it's more compact, but with no place to take it. We could ship it to Seattle, but this is Holden, you know, we're struggling for all the money that we can get in here just to keep the buildings, you know, up. So it's, even though that's what we want to do, we really can't, because we just don't have the money to do it. And it is a big problem. What do you do? Your hands are kind of tied.
Send everybody who lives in Seattle home with a big box and we can bring glass and brown glass.
Huh. You're willing.
We can put it on curbside if, you know.
Because you can do curbside brown glass. Yeah. Wow, that's an exciting. And that was one, at one time, the proposal for how to get rid of the tailings, too, was right. Send everyone home. But this, I mean, the glass actually could be recycled. I figured. How about composting? Have people started trying that? Uh-huh.
I'm Betsy Cruz from Seattle, and two people in our household, but of course, Seattle has a big recycling program. I often wonder sometimes, though, where all of that is going, and is it really being recycled, and, you know, all of that, because it seems like that balance is the issue. But we have a worm bin, which we got from the city for free, and then someone came out with worms and told me how to use it. And we've been doing that for about 4 years, and between the two of us, we just have one little bag of garbage a week that goes out. So that's how much goes away with the garbage, and the rest goes recycling or compost, which I use in the garden. They have lots of worms.
I need some worms. My worms died. I need new ones. And I've taken them on the airplane, so I know that'll work. No, I think having worms is one of the really fun things. Others, Mark, could you?
Well, I was going to go back to this, you know, what do you do about the market? And one thing that I did living in Minneapolis, something I called up the Minneapolis Star Tribune, which is the newspaper, and said, I'm using recycled paper. And, you know, maybe every newspaper in the country these days is using recycled newspaper, but
just to say, here, I'm a subscriber, and I'm going to keep subscribing if you're willing to do that. And just for the Minneapolis Star Tribune, they said they wanted to use more, but they couldn't get a hold of it. So.
Liar, liar, pants and fire.
Well, I think,
there's a lot of that. And it's also, they could have also been using 5% recycled paper.
Well, I mean, the gentleman on the phone, you know, I didn't really test the validity of the phone conversation, but that they were using whatever they could get as far as recycled paper. But you know, if enough people call that local newspaper, or you know, if there are other places that are major users of newspaper, start to have an impact. Hopefully.
Well, is it not efficient for industries to use recycled products? Is that it?
I think there's kind of a problem in keeping the recycled paper a high grade, I think. Your nice Xerox paper is brand new paper, but newspaper and other recycled paper, if you like go to Target or Walmart and you buy the recycled notebooks that use recycled paper, maybe, I don't know, 75% or something, you'll notice the quality is a little bit less. And I think they lose some quality in recycling.
Well, I think it gets to the question, too, of the definition of efficiency. A newspaper can't afford to use recycled paper if all the newspapers don't have to, because, I mean, it has to be the law, because, I mean, at this point, because trees are cheaper, but I mean, I think that's what we learned to work for here is, and some companies even ask for that so that they can do more without completely losing out.
Doesn't it go back to what does the consumer want?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, a consumer wants a high grade quality something. And if we expect that, we don't want something that's low grade or partial grade. It goes back to what standard of living you want to live with. And, you know, that's your paper. I mean, what kind of quality paper do you want to produce with what kind of other stuff?
Are you going to send your resume on recycled paper again?
Well, and and your newspapers or any competitive business is going to try to say, in anything, it's like at the church that I was at, the ongoing debate was, should we blacktop the parking lot or should we not? Now, if you look at church growth stuff, you better blacktop your parking lot because it gives you an appearance that will draw people. And people won't walk in mud. And people don't want to walk in mud. But the other side is. So what is it that, you know, people are expecting?
Why don't we're down in the last, I should have run the 10-minute bill a few minutes ago, but we have, I don't know, 7 more minutes or so. So if you haven't talked yet and you'd like to, feel free. I'm interested in light of, this is probably too wide a scale of topics, but as you think about Independence Day, the 4th of July, your own sense of patriotism, how can interdependence be a part of that, and how do you think of being an American but also being a global citizen? And this week, a whole citizen, of course. Is that triggering anything with any of you? Paving the parking lot makes you think about Holden's alternative. I don't know what year this was when they decided to pave the road here with molasses.
Yes.
And well, it was some ecological idea. I mean, we've tried a lot of things that haven't worked. The artichokes mean many things. You just try different things, but the road was paved with this organic molasses compound, and then for years after that, the deer came down and ate it. The deer are still licking this. Yeah, so if you ever see the deer licking the street, that is why. That was one of our... I mean, Holden's a place where you could try things, so I don't know if your church wants to consider a molasses park.
But for Holden to do that, they ripped out a perfectly good tar road.
Yes.
You can see down the road where the tar begins again.
And they don't lick there, yes. Well, it was breaking up. It was
Can we crush up our brown and green glass and put it in the concrete that's for the
garage?
For the garage.
There you go.
Yeah. They do
is
make.
That, is that a sound practice? And
it would look pretty.
You know, Barbara,
I've thought for a long time that I need to think of recycling and being ecologically active as the same way I think about tithing. I need to set aside time every week or every month or some chunk of time regularly that I would decide to devote to this. And what I need to do in Chicago right now is we have a stupid blue bag program. There was this great recycling thing in my neighborhood, Uptown Recycling, and then the blue bag program came in, which is you put all your recyclables in big blue plastic bags into your garbage along with all your other garbage. And if you believe this, I have a bridge I'll sell you in Brooklyn. But they claim then that magically they will pick out all these bags full of glass and tin and newspapers and stuff from the main garbage stream and put it in a separate place and open all the bags, see what's in them, divide it up, and recycle it. And I have a friend who lives in a very poor, distant corner of Chicago who travels on public transportation, and she's watching the mountain of blue bags grow in a place in her neighborhood. And we all know that it's very unlikely, in the first place, what percentage of your blue plastic bags are going to survive the process. You know, when you throw them in your dumpster already, some of them break. You know, and you have to buy official blue bags from the grocery store. So it's total bogus thing, and it's made Uptown Recycling, this wonderful recycling center, close down because they don't have enough business anymore because everyone uses the blue bags. It's easier to use the blue bags. So I should use my time. I should have this tithing of time that I would be committed, and I should be calling City Hall and yelling about this and organizing a campaign and getting letter writing, and I should be protesting it. I know about it, but I don't do anything. So I feel like as a Christian, it's really my job to figure out a way to get myself and my friends to do something about it, besides just having worms on my counter like Barb Rossing does.
It's really fun to have worms. Jackie, did you have your hand up?
Well, I was just wondering, I know that Namibia included the environment in its constitution, right? When it formed in 1990. And I mean, I don't know what, you know, in the grand scale things, if it's made any difference, but I think it's a model for the rest of the world to pay attention to. And I don't know if anyone has followed that or if South Africa did now, and they, you know, also maybe Jonathan was.
No, I don't. I know that the things agreed to in Rio and about a zillion other conferences are by and large nice words on paper.
Right.
And that's what this last meeting, 2 weeks ago in New York, basically was a time for the world to come to face with the fact that what they said 5 years ago has not happened. They were going to reduce greenhouse gases to 1990 levels, for example, by the year 2002 or something. Well, that's not happening.
Go ahead.
I just want to say, everything we mentioned, what encourages me is you can do something about everything we mentioned, basically. You know, about garbage, about fuel consumption, about if they're building golf courses, there are new standards that they can live by, perhaps. These are doable things. I mean, you can eat lower on the food, you can do Holden-type things in your regular life. And that's a start, and obviously we have to go beyond that to other areas. But you know, we've heard right here what you look for to buy as you go around in the church, in the supermarket, the way it's packaged and so on. And isn't that a way to work within our system, obviously? And I think it's a way that was doing pretty good about 25 years ago, and then something happened.
Yeah.
Pardon?
Plastic.
Yeah. We had plastic.
I know, but our church, we had a real good recycling program going, and we had to
transport some of it down to a town, and this one grocery store would, as long as we bagged it and prepared it right, do it the 2-4s and then the mix, the 1-5-7s, then we had the styrofoam trays and all that kind of stuff, the 6s and the 5s, some of them there were that styrofoam type. And all of a sudden, they had no market for it anymore, so they stopped that. So we had to close our little recycling garage and encourage our people to bring it down to another supermarket in town that is accepting some things, but they don't accept all of the things that we recycled anymore because they have no market for it in Portland. So, it, you know, you really feel frustrated when you can't. We had a good thing going, and now all of a sudden the people say, well, I'm just going to throw out my garbage. I'm not going to haul it down there.
Dorothy, did you have your hand up? Okay, well, thank you, everybody. I just wanted to close here with a quote from President Clinton's speech, who I would say has been a disappointment as an environmentalist, in my opinion. I don't know what the rest of you think. And here he, I think he's misquoting scripture, so I'll just read you this way. this is the end of his speech. Distinguished leaders, in all our cultures, we have been taught from time immemorial that, as scripture says, one generation passes away and another comes, but the earth abides forever. I think it's supposed to be the word of God, abides forever, but anyway. He is speaking, at least in favor of environmental progress, and I think we have to hold him to that. And I guess I would say, as a longtime Holden person, that one of the things that I find the most inspiring to me about coming here is finding a community of people like you who like to talk about these issues and have ideas, and now worms to help me, and that we can be in conversation together, and that our task as global citizens is immense, and our country is, as we've heard tonight, part of the problem, as well as a country that can be a place of transformation. So thanks everybody for sharing ideas. Let's keep the conversation going informally around the courtyard tomorrow or through the week. But thank you very much, and thanks to our panelists.